Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Thursday, the 14th of December. The Israeli Prime Minister defies calls for a ceasefire in Gaza, saying the war will go on until Hamas is defeated.
I say this in the face of great pain, but also in the face of international pressure. Nothing will stop us. We will go on to the end.
Joe Biden's son Hunter refuses to testify in private in Congress and instead gives a news conference at the Capitol. And investigators say the Wagner mercenary group made $2.5 billion for the Russian war effort by smuggling gold from Africa. Also in the podcast, why 2 million Teslas are being recalled in the US. And
going to the military itself isn't exactly a pleasant experience for the majority and does feel like a huge imposition on them and something that they just don't feel they should have to do if they don't want to.
Should the world-famous K-pop band BTS have been exempt from military service? On the podcast this time yesterday, we reported on the US president's strongest criticism yet of what he called Israel's indiscriminate bombing of Gaza, as well as the demand for an immediate ceasefire from three-quarters of the world's nations in a vote at the UN. On Wednesday, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu issued a defiant response, saying his forces will not stop until they've defeated Hamas.
And yet, I want to say in the clearest possible terms what I just said to the commander in the field. We will continue to the end. There is absolutely no question of that. I say this in the face of great pain, but also in the face of international pressure. We will go on to the end, to victory, nothing less.
Well, the White House said that it had reiterated its concerns about civilian casualties in Gaza, which run into many thousands. Here's the U.S. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller.
We have seen too many civilians killed. We understand Israel's intent, but what also matters is the results. We continue to monitor what's happening. We continue to collect information at a variety of levels, and we continue to engage in conversations with the Israeli government about the importance of adhering to international humanitarian law.
Well, the U.S. National Security spokesman said that Israel had shown it was trying to act on international concerns by, for example, carrying out fewer airstrikes. At the same time, fierce fighting is continuing in Gaza, where Israel says 10 of its soldiers, including a full colonel, were killed over the previous 24 hours. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Hugo Bachega, told me what it all means for the Israeli military operation.
This is evidence that pressure is growing, and even from Israel's most important ally, the United States. So Jake Sullivan, who is the national security advisor, will be in Israel on Thursday talking to Prime Minister Netanyahu. Also, the war cabinet, Israeli media are reporting one of the topics to be discussed is a timeline for the end of the war. Prime Minister Netanyahu is saying that the war continues, but I think the reality is perhaps a little bit different.
Do we have any idea of how close Israel is to meeting its objectives? I see they've suffered their biggest single-day loss for about 6 weeks, reporting that 10 soldiers were killed over the past 24 hours. So presumably there'll also be pressure from people inside Israel.
I don't think they're very close to declaring victory, because just this week Hamas was firing rockets at Israel and the top leadership hasn't been captured. We're seeing this massive operation now in Khan Yunis, where the leader of Hamas in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, comes from, and this is where the Israeli authorities believe that members of the Hamas leadership are hiding. But those people haven't been captured, and Hamas still has the capacity to fight back. I think in Israel, there's still a lot of support for this operation against Hamas, but there's also pressure on the Prime Minister to secure any kind of deal for the release of the hostages. Remember that more than 100 people still remain in captivity in Gaza.
Now, in his reported comments on Tuesday, Joe Biden singled out the hard right government in Israel for some criticism. Has that featured at all in the Israeli media, perhaps?
So this is the most hardline and religious government in Israel's history. It was very interesting yesterday that President Biden said that Prime Minister Netanyahu had to change its government because he said it was a government that was against the two-state solution, which is the favored proposal by the international community that sees the creation of an independent Palestinian state. What is interesting is that Israeli media, the way they're seeing these comments by the Prime Minister is that perhaps he's trying to address concerns from his right-wing supporters. So he's playing a little bit of domestic politics, if you like. And don't forget, lots of questions about his policies, his decisions prior to the attacks. And many say that because of those decisions, he allowed those attacks to happen. So a lot of pressure on the Prime Minister from all sides.
Hugo Bechega in Jerusalem. Joe Biden's son, Hunter, has long been in the sights of Republicans as they target the US president. Hunter Biden has also faced criminal charges, including for drugs, gun and tax offences. But on Wednesday, he risked further jeopardy by defying an order by Republicans in the House of Representatives to testify behind closed doors about his business dealings. He said he was prepared to give evidence, but only in public. And he proceeded to give a news conference on the steps of the Capitol building.
During my battle with addiction, my parents were there for me. They literally saved my life. And in the depths of my addiction, I was extremely irresponsible with my finances. But to suggest that is grounds for an impeachment inquiry is beyond the absurd. It's shameless. There is no evidence to support the allegations that my father was financially involved in my business because it did not happen.
Well, the House Republicans are trying to find evidence of corruption as part of their effort to impeach President Biden. I asked our correspondent in Washington, Nomia Iqbal, about the implications of Hunter Biden's refusal to obey the Republican subpoena.
He could now be held in contempt of Congress, and this is what those Republicans on the Oversight Committee are saying, and that could potentially carry a jail sentence. We don't know fully what the next step will be. But look, I think it's really significant that Hunter Biden spoke in the way he did. It's a very rare emotional statement in which he was publicly lashing out at Republicans. So I think in that respect, it's significant. Also, it's the first time we've heard from him since he was facing those criminal charges. He's going on trial next year, and this is to do with gun possession and tax evasion.
I guess also by offering to testify in public, some people might suggest that this whole row is politicized. And of course, it comes as Republicans move to try to impeach President Biden. What's happening there?
On the first point that you made, that's really interesting because also Hunter Biden is basically saying, look, I'll testify for this committee, but I will do it publicly so everyone can see it rather than doing it behind closed doors because he doesn't trust this investigation. Now, in terms of the impeachment inquiry, that's been going on since September, since the Republicans, Kevin McCarthy, the then House Speaker, announced it unilaterally. And so it's not an official inquiry. Jim Jordan, who's on the House Oversight Committee, has said, in terms of what happens next, they're going to hopefully interview everyone they need to for this investigation, and that they will decide early next year if to then go ahead, if they've got the evidence they need to go with an impeachment vote. But what's going to happen tonight is they're going to formalise something that they've already been doing, which is investigating whether there should be an impeachment.
Nomia Iqbal in Washington. The European Commission has unlocked funding for Hungary worth up to $11 billion. It had been frozen in a dispute about the rule of law. The unfreezing came on the eve of a European Union leaders' summit at which the Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán, was threatening to block key decisions on Ukraine. From Brussels, here's Danny Eberhardt.
With tensions building over Hungary's lone stance on Ukraine comes what could be a decisive move. The European Commission insists it's been following due process and that the frozen funds are being released as Hungary has taken the measures it had committed to bolster judicial independence. The Commission does not link the step to Hungary threatening to block both new funds for Ukraine and moves to open talks with Kiev on joining the EU at the leaders' summit. But critics say it's responded to blackmail by Prime Minister Orbán. One outraged Green MEP called it the biggest bribe in EU history.
Danny Eberhardt. The Russian mercenary group Wagner has been active in Africa for at least 6 years, but has largely escaped detailed scrutiny. Now, Western researchers have revealed that the group has made $2.5 billion from smuggling African gold, with the money helping to fund the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The Blood Gold Report found that Wagner was involved in the illegal gold trade in Sudan, the Central African Republic and Mali, as I heard from our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton.
In the Central African Republic, Wagner has been given the exclusive rights to the largest gold mine in the country. And similarly, in Darfur, a refinery has been given in Sudan, has been given to Wagner. The report says that in these countries, the Kremlin relies on complex smuggling routes and corporate subterfuge, so that's like bogus companies, to extract large amounts of blood gold out of the continent into Russia and the UAE, where it's mixed with legitimate sources of gold and then converted, i.e. sold, for cash. And then slightly differently in Mali, the junta there gets most of its tax revenue from international mining companies like a Canadian corporation called Barrick Gold Corp. And effectively, Wagner is propping up the military regime, and these mining companies are effectively paying Wagner's salaries. One of the report's authors is David Clement, who's a Canadian researcher, and he was focusing on Mali.
We're calling on governments to deliver sanctions that stop Russia profiting from blood gold, and for companies like Canada's Barrick Gold to get out of Mali, because we are now at a point where these mining companies provide more than 50% of the state's total revenue. And we know, based on numerous accounts, that a significant portion of that revenue is going to the Wagner mercenary group. And I can't see how any of those companies who operate there can continue to do so knowing that they are funding Putin's mercenaries. For Western companies, they have to ask themselves the question of whether or not they're comfortable funding that.
David Clement, one of the authors of the Blood Gold Report. And what does this pressure group say should be done about it all?
So they want wider sanctions. They want stringent controls on the supply chain. This actually happened in terms of blood diamonds and the trade that came from rebels in Sierra Leone about 20 years ago. And they want a greater responsibility from these mining companies. They want Wagner to be designated as a terrorist organization. And they want the West to support the existing democratic states in Africa, which are feeling threatened by Wagner. So what we've seen is Russia always has this anti-imperialistic rhetoric, but it seems like they are now doing the same thing. They're exploiting Africa for its resources for dubious ends while committing horrendous human rights abuses.
Richard Hamilton, our Africa regional editor. The Hollywood actor Denzel Washington is causing something of a stir in Tunisia after he was cast to play Hannibal, the ancient general who famously crossed the Alps to fight the Romans. The Carthaginian leader came from what is modern-day Tunisia, and some there have questioned the actor's suitability for the part, seemingly because he is African-American. Local media have described it as a historical error. An online petition signed by 1,300 people has urged Netflix to cancel the production. James Copnell spoke to the Tunisian film critic Farouk Fachichi, who started by explaining how important Hannibal is to Tunisians.
Hannibal Barca is one of the greatest military leader in history. He's like Alexander the Great for Greeks or Napoleon for French. So he's a very emblematic figure for Tunisians. And in all these years, his face remains unreachable and unified. There's a need to put a face on it and to give a life to his story. And cinema in Tunisia is not capable of doing such an epic. So such a news would be very exciting for Tunisians to see this amazing adventure of his in the big screen.
And yet it seems that some people are not happy. Why?
Hannibal, as I said, he doesn't have a known face except of an ancient statue in Napoli Museum. So people imagine his face, but we know that he's Phoenician, so his origins are from Lebanon, I mean his ancestry, but his family is aristocratic family that lived for centuries in North Africa, in Tunisia. So he would probably be like Tunisians see themselves, as well as all North Africans, like we say, whitish or light brown. Mm. And so for many people, it's a bit weird or inaccurate to see him with the face of Denzel Washington.
Farouk Fachichi talking to James Copnell. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
Ariana Grande's Santa Tell Me was not well received when it came out about a decade ago. That's one of the songs you hear in the shops everywhere all the time now. It's definitely a Christmas classic now.
With nostalgia all the rage, what are the Christmas classics of the future? The deal, finally agreed on Wednesday morning after all-night negotiations at the UN Climate Summit in Dubai, certainly didn't please all the nearly 200 nations involved. But it did win praise from some, including the UN chief, for finally recognising the need to transition away from fossil fuels. President Biden said it was a historic milestone, and the EU chief, Ursula von der Leyen, said it marked the start of the post-fossil era. But the former US Vice President Al Gore said there were loopholes that betrayed what he called the influence of petrostates, and small island nations say they were ignored. These climate activists gave their reaction.
The latest version of the text that has just been approved is better than the one we had yesterday. But the one we had yesterday was so bad that it is easy to do better.
We were told this was going to be a historic COP, and the outcome is far from it. It's lukewarm at best.
What we are missing is finance that is massively needed to support developing countries to transition away from fossil fuels.
While we are upset at the results, there's people here who are celebrating. And, you know, we're giving crumbs to celebrate, but it's like asking us to celebrate flowers that will lie on our graves.
Well, energy-producing countries welcomed the deal, saying it won't affect their ability to export oil. Our climate editor, Justin Rolat, considers how much the agreement will contribute to efforts to cut carbon emissions.
The final deal is stronger than it looked like it was going to be at one stage, but the language is still slippery. That is perhaps inevitable, given it is attempting to forge a consensus between the almost 200 countries of the world. The big win is that the words fossil fuels appear in the final resolution, even if the call is only for countries to contribute to taking action on climate change. My metaphor is the washing up. If I tell my wife I'm going to contribute to the effort to wash up, I'm likely to get short shrift from her. But despite that, this deal does represent progress. The hope is that sending a fairly clear signal of the world's intention to progressively lessen its dependence on fossil fuels will create a disincentive for investment. And it will also add momentum to something that appears elsewhere in the text, an entreaty to massively increase the rollout of clean energy systems. This agreement is far from perfect. It may not demand all the action the science says is necessary, but it does show us that the world can sometimes at least begin to move in the right direction.
Our climate editor, Justin Rolat. Global markets have reacted cautiously to the news that Argentina will devalue its peso. The news came just 2 days after Javier Milei took office as the new leader amid promises of radical action to tackle a growing financial crisis in the South American country. Inflation, or the rate at which prices increase, is nearing 150% there, and two-fifths of the population live in poverty. Here's the new economy minister, Luis Caputo, speaking in a TV address on Tuesday night.
In other words, we're going to be worse off than before for a few months, particularly in terms of inflation. And I say that because, as the president says, it's better to tell an uncomfortable truth than a comfortable lie.
Well, the action has been welcomed by the International Monetary Fund, which is owed $33 billion by Argentina. Our South America correspondent, Katie Watson, reports.
Javier Milei's administration isn't wasting time in implementing its promised shock therapy to fix Argentina's financial problems. In a televised speech last night, the new economy minister, Luis Caputo, said he'd cut the peso's official exchange rate by more than 50% to 800 pesos to the dollar. It was part of a much-awaited package of measures that also included cutting energy and transport subsidies, as well as slashing government ministries and jobs. Mr. Caputo warned that the effects would be painful in the short term. Argentina isn't the first country to devalue its currency this year. Egypt, Lebanon, Nigeria and Pakistan have also made similar moves. Devaluation makes imported goods more expensive, adding to inflation, which is already running at more than 140% a year in Argentina. It can also make it more expensive to make payments on foreign debts. So why do it? It makes exports cheaper and more attractive to foreign buyers, helping to grow the economy. The IMF, to which Argentina is heavily indebted, said the move was bold and would improve public finances and stabilise the economy in the long term.
Katie Watson. Now let me take you back to the 30th of July 2020 and a NASA launch at Kennedy Space Center.
Five. Four. Engine ignition. 2, 1, 0. And liftoff. As the countdown to Mars continues, the perseverance of humanity launching the next generation of robotic explorers to the Red Planet.
Well, 7 months after taking off from Florida, Perseverance eventually landed on Mars. And for the past 1,000 days, it has been exploring. Now, the US Space Agency says the rover has essentially completed the job it was sent up there to do. The announcement was made at a major science conference in San Francisco. Our correspondent Jonathan Amos was there, and he told me more about the rover's mission.
It was asked to go into a big crater on the northern side of Mars, a place called Jezero Crater. It's about 45 kilometres across. It's an old impact basin. And it was asked to survey that, to study the rocks. And then it was asked to drill those rocks, to collect up a whole load of samples that could be sent back to Earth at some point in the future, which may be able to tell us that Mars was not just habitable 3.5 billion years ago, but also actually had life. Maybe within those rock samples are evidence of ancient biology on the Red Planet. So it's been all over the crater, and it's drilled a whole series of rocks, different types of rocks. And if you were to bring those rocks back today, you'd go, great, thanks very much, Perseverance. Job well done. And that's essentially what NASA have said to the Perseverance team.
How are we going to get these rocks back to Earth to analyse them?
It's something that NASA's going to do with the European Space Agency. It will involve sending a rocket to the surface of Mars, putting the samples that Perseverance has gathered into that rocket and then blasting them into space for the journey home. It is an extraordinary robotic endeavour that will cost billions of dollars, and NASA is not sure that it has the money just at the moment to do it. The European Space Agency is already starting to build hardware for this mission, but when it actually takes place, we're going to have to wait for a review panel to report in the new year. Chinese are going to go soon and try and do this, so maybe that will egg them on a little bit. But I can't tell you right at the moment when those rock samples that Perseverance has tucked away in its belly, when they will come back to Earth.
While we wait, what will Perseverance be doing up on the Red Planet?
It's going to climb out of this crater. It's going to look at rocks that are even older than are in Jezero Crater to try and see if there were habitable environments further back in time, you know, maybe a little bit more than 4 billion years ago, and see if there might be clues to life on the Red Planet way, way back in the history of the solar system.
Our science correspondent Jonathan Amos in San Francisco. The world's most valuable car maker, Tesla, has issued a recall for 2 million vehicles after safety regulators found problems with the autopilot system. They'd been investigating crashes involving Tesla's special driver assistance software. The firm, owned by Elon Musk, said it would send a software update to fix the problem. More details from our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
The recall covers almost every Tesla sold in the US since Autopilot was launched in 2015. But the cars won't have to be returned to a showroom. Tesla will send a software update to affected vehicles over the air, similar to the way in which smartphones and laptops get operating system updates. Contrary to its name, Autopilot is not allowed to take over from human control. The US regulator was specifically concerned about one of its features called Auto Steer, which is designed to keep the vehicle in the correct lane and match the speed of surrounding traffic. But it's still supposed to alert drivers if they take their hands off the wheel or lose concentration. Tesla said the software update should encourage drivers to remain alert. The decision affects US-based Teslas only, but its cars are on the roads in many other countries as well, including the UK.
Zoe Kleinman. Now for a bit of K-pop.
When I look in the mirror, I'm not too hard to do. I got the
Well, I'm reliably informed that that is Butter by the South Korean boy band BTS. They have been forced to swap their microphones for military fatigues at the height of their fame. On Tuesday, the lead vocalist, Jungkook, joined the rest of the band in enlisting for military service, a requirement for all able-bodied South Korean men aged 18 to 28. So how have the millions of fans of the world-famous K-pop band reacted to their compulsory 18-month breakup? Nuala McGovern spoke to Dr. Sarah Son, a senior lecturer in Korean studies at the University of Sheffield.
I think it's a mixture of a sort of outpouring of grief and despair that they're going to be off the scene because one member, so Jungkook, has had huge success over the last few months. Even in the UK, you just hear his songs playing constantly. And I think there's a sense that they're going to be disappearing from sight, particularly as their presence is so pervasive on social media and on television and in popular news. But I think there's also an understanding that this is sort of part of Korea's legal and cultural landscape, and it's just something that has to happen as well. So I think there's a resignation to it, and I hope that they'll be back afterwards.
They're pop stars and they're huge and they're known around the world, but they're not exempt from military service. But some athletes and classical musicians are. Why the disparity?
Well, I think this is a system that has been part of Korea's politics since it was founded in 1948. And so back then, the only way that someone could achieve national prestige internationally for South Korea was in international sporting events, classical music competitions. It's only very recently that K-pop has become not only a space where individuals and groups could achieve international prestige for Korea, but it's also much more accessible globally. It's drowned out all of those other, I think, spaces where Korea does achieve recognition and prize winning, I suppose. I think they're definitely having some difficult discussions domestically. I think the National Defense Ministry or whatever the equivalent is had to do a survey of public sentiment around this, which still found that quite a large number of people actually did think that groups like BTS should be exempt. But yeah, there is a real tension there that is sort of, I think, perhaps taken policymakers unawares, and they're having to have some really difficult conversations.
And what about young South Koreans? And it's just men that do military service.
Compulsorily, yes.
Yes, compulsory. Is there any pushback against them doing it in that larger arena, even away from the pop stars and the musicians?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's been a key issue among others in the last few years where men have started to be more vocal about the problems that it causes for them entering the job market later than women. So they feel that they have more catching up to do. And just going to the military itself isn't exactly a pleasant experience for the majority, and does feel like a huge imposition on them, and something that they just don't feel they should have to do if they don't want to.
Nuala McGovern talking to Dr. Sarah Son. This time of year, it can be hard to get away from Christmas music. Many of the songs on the playlist in shops and at parties actually go back decades. Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas or Frosty the Snowman, even Fairy Tale of New York by The Pogues, whose frontman Shane McGowan died last month. But are new Christmas songs being written that will be hits in the future? Evan Davis spoke to the Sunday Times music journalist Lisa Verrico.
Pop at the moment is incredibly nostalgic. People love discovering old songs which are new to them and finding out the history of songs. So pop is definitely going through a nostalgia phase at the moment. But you could say pop is catching up with Christmas because we've always listened to old Christmas songs. Very difficult to get a new Christmas song away now. They're so popular, everybody wants, they make so much money, but very few people are having hits with them.
Let us talk through a few that people can add to their Christmas playlist to freshen them up. And we have to start with Taylor Swift. If anybody can make something work in 2023, it's got to be Taylor Swift.
Christmas Tree Farm, which came out a couple of years ago. Taylor Swift did grow up on a Christmas tree farm. I would not say it's a classic Taylor Swift song, but you never know because Christmas songs now are a bit of a slow burn. So you could find it in the next few years becoming a Christmas staple, but at the minute it's quite far away from that.
Suggest another one then. Santa, tell me if you're really there. Don't make me fall in love again if he won't be here next year. Santa, tell me if
Ariana Grande's Santa Tell Me was not well received when it came out about a decade ago. And that is one of these songs a bit like Mariah's All I Want for Christmas that every year has got bigger and bigger. That's one of the songs you hear in the shops everywhere all the time now. So that's been a big slow burn, but that's definitely a Christmas classic now, I think. Yeah. I did a Christmas rundown a couple of years ago for the Sunday Times, and Jack Savaretti had brought out a song called Christmas Morning. It's got, when you were talking about Fairy Tale of New York, it's got a kind of folksy feel to it. It's absolutely beautiful. I definitely seek that one out. That's definitely always on my Christmas list.
Christmas morning, I'll be here, and you can tell me what you see. May your nightmares turn to dreams.
So, Lisa, yeah, what do you think Christmas number one is going to be this year?
It would be lovely if Fairy Tale of New York was number one. I think everybody would like that. Honestly, if I was going to bet a lot of money on it, I'd stick with Mariah Carey.
Lisa Verrico talking to Evan Davis about her Christmas music favourites. Now, before we go, there's been a development while we've been recording on Republican efforts to impeach the US President Joe Biden. The House of Representatives has voted along party lines to open an impeachment inquiry. The Republicans have alleged bribery and corruption during Mr. Biden's tenure as vice president. He denies wrongdoing. And Democrats have dismissed the Republican moves against the Biden family as a political stunt.
Today's impeachment inquiry vote is indeed part of the continuing effort to deny Joe Biden the office of president of the United States. And we saw it happen on January 6, 2021, when Donald Trump incited a violent insurrection to overturn the presidential election, to set aside the work of Congress in the peaceful transfer of power, to disrupt Vice President Pence in the execution of his duties. And they tried to stop Biden from becoming president then. And now this ridiculous impeachment drive continues the effort to keep Biden from being able to do his presidential duties.
Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Ethan Connolly Forster and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.